All right, a couple of announcements. We're beginning to get the setup schedule set up for 2021, so if you want to apply in that regard, or we could just pray that they never use this room again. That would be great. That's something we are going to have to consider, by the way. We've got a board meeting coming up this next week, so we're going to have to consider what happens, how much more risk we have when everybody here is well, and well people don't spread disease, so that's not a problem, but we don't have any idea on who will be coming and going in here and what their procedures are going to be, so we're going to be looking into all of that in order to keep things just as safe as we possibly can. But in an environment like this, when generally you're not on top of each other and everybody's facing the same direction, the odds of spread would be very, very small, minuscule to start with. And as we pointed out, the figures have all been wildly inflated on this, so that's another deal. Okay, also, just to let you know, I think Mary and the boys are having one final test here today, but everybody's symptom-free, their tests have all been negative with the exception of Ryan, and so they'll should know by Wednesday what their situation is. Pete apparently has come down with something. He was exposed through somebody apparently on his job. The guy's father got it. But he's had two negative tests since then, so he may just have a cold or the flu. So certainly pray for him. And if you want to take him some chicken soup, feel free. Or some matzo ball soup or whatever, if you're Jewish. So, all right, let's make sure we're in fellowship here and continue on. Dealing with this matter, again, the negative examples of people who don't use good sense spiritually, who are maybe deficient a little bit intellectually, but that's not really the problem with the fool. He might be quite wise from the human standpoint. The Carl Sagan, Stephen Hawking types, they're really smart from the human standpoint, but fools when it comes to God's plan. But they're believers now, so I guess a little late, but they're believers anyway. And I don't mean saved as in they're believers. I mean they believe in hell now. That's what they do where they are. Well, Roman numeral 4 here, we're ready to continue on with the next major point, the fool and his relationship with God. The first thing that one must understand with respect to foolish activity is that all unbelievers, including those who are positive, and I mean, when I talk about positive unbelievers, I mean somebody who's eventually going to make the adjustments, somebody who's going to get saved. They're not saved yet. And all of us at one time, whether we knew it or not, were positive unbelievers. But they would make the salvation adjustment. They act foolishly because they do not recognize God, His plan, or His wisdom. Titus 3:3. And so, just because, even if you're a positive unbeliever, though, there's no guarantee you're going to be protected from your own stupidity, other than we do know that God keeps people alive. I've been reflecting on that some. I was thinking about it over the last week. Of all the potential times I should have been dead. The big major ones, like the motorcycle wreck, I should have died in that. Shouldn't be walking. Shouldn't certainly be walking pain-free, as I mostly do. That's obviously, I attribute that nothing more than God's blessing, that sound doctrine is healing to the bones. And so, but there were other times I did really stupid stuff. I remember we were invited to a party once, so we all dropped acid and jumped on the freeway and we're going 90 miles an hour. And or if I'd have ever been caught or pulled over by the police, I mean, I would have a totally different experience. So, a number of times I should have been dead, but God keeps the positive alive because they have to have time to make the adjustments. But again, even then I was stupid. There's no doubt about it. And he talks about this in our pre-salvation state in verse 3. For we also, even those of us who are saved now, once were foolish ourselves. Now that varies from person to person. If you got saved as a younger child, probably, you didn't go out and do all the same stupidity and all that the rest of us did. But as I've told kids, if they pay attention and listen, most of them don't, but you didn't miss anything. It isn't as though that lifestyle was so great that I thought, no, I was ready to trade it all for salvation. Having a life that was meant something. So we were foolish ourselves, disobedient, deceived, enslaved to various lusts and pleasures, spending our life in malice and envy, hateful, hating one another. That describes the state, generally speaking, of unbelievers. They are not characterized by love. They are not characterized by wisdom. And they're characterized by sinful, selfish self-indulgence. That's the unbeliever. That's from the biblical perspective. But again, they may have a nice facade. They might look good. They might be cultured, mannered, all this. But they're still these things, unfortunately. So the habitual fool denies the existence of God, since he has rejected the internal witness to God's existence as well as the external witness of creation. Psalm 14:1. For the choir director, a psalm of David. The fool has said in his heart, "There is no God. They are corrupt. They have committed abominable deeds. There is no one who does good." And this is the psalm, parts of this are, that were, and I think other passages as well, that Paul links together in Romans, there in Romans 3, as he describes the state of the human race from the divine viewpoint. "The Lord has looked down from heaven," verse 2, "upon the sons of men, to see if there are any who understand, who seek after God. They have all turned aside. Together they have become corrupt. There is no one who does good, not even one." And that's the indictment of the human race from the divine viewpoint. People say, well, the world isn't that bad. God says it is. And I'm going to go ahead and take his assessment on this. But the big thing is, he has said in his heart, the heart again is the fundamental you. It's the real you. It's the current you. So you can have, quote, a change of heart. That you fundamentally revamp maybe your ideas or your standards or something. We have a doctrine of the heart, and there's a lot of idioms that use the idea of heart. But the heart is the central focal point of everything, and it's in that sense, it's not the soul, because the soul, you can grow spiritually in your soul. But the heart is who you are like right this second. And this is all the things that have made you, brought you up to this point, who you are. And the fool, in his innermost person, says there's no God. That's his innermost thinking. That's one of his fundamental precepts by which he lives life. Also, Ecclesiastes 3:1. I'm not sure why I wanted that one.
3:11.
3:11, is that it? Okay, there you go. Here's God now. And the way he works in the human race. In verse 11 here. God has made everything appropriate to its time. And that's the whole, if you remember the birds, they made a song out of this. There is a season. There's an appropriate time for everything. Time to give up, time not to give up. Time to love, time to hate. And people don't like that. They think, no, God is all love. He just loves at all times. We'll see when he unleashes his wrath how many people think he really loves them. And it's about to be unleashed. He has made everything appropriate to his time. He has also set eternity in their heart. And what does that mean? That means that even unbelievers out there have some sense that there's an eternal future. That there's more to this than just life here. That they have some sense of these things. Yet, he's done this so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning to the end. And we don't know, and again, of course, we can't fully know ever. You would have to be there with God and observe all this and look at his wisdom, see how he functioned and all of that. But nobody was there. That's why it's foolish to argue about creation. When did God create the world? Nobody knows exactly. The time is not really relevant to anything that I know about. I don't know of any good reason that it makes any difference why a believer needs to know what year the world was created in. How does it help you live the Christian life? It doesn't. I mean, we want to be as accurate as we can on the one hand. I'm not denigrating accuracy or, you know, being as precise as we can. But the fact is, the Bible never says when the world was created. Now, what we can say safely from the biblical chronology is that man has been on the planet about 6,000 years. And so is the planet 7,000 years old, 10,000? There's good evidence that it may not be much more than 10,000 years old. There's pretty good scientific evidence. Is it billions and billions of years? I doubt it. Because that's one of the problems with the whole evolutionary thing. And they fail to take into account that the whole thing was created with an illusion of age. I mean, God speaks the entire universe into existence, and you see this gigantic boulder sitting there, and you think to yourself, wow, that rock's been around a while. No, it hadn't. It's about 1 second old. But when you carbon date it, it's 14 billion years old. No, it's not really. But again, carbon dating is an effective way really to measure time, frankly. It has inherent flaws within that system. So God has put all of this in people's hearts. They know that they have some sense. That and even as an unbeliever, I had the sense that God existed. And I wondered about stuff. What's heaven going to be like? For me, when I was 9 years old, I just thought heaven was a place you went and played baseball all the time. That was heaven for me. Field of Dreams kind of stuff, you know. And that was kind of a cool movie. Weird, but, you know, it's not doctrinal. But again, I don't go to the movies to get my doctrine. So again, he has placed this in their heart. And men cannot deny this witness. Now, they will deny it. They have denied it. But they cannot effectively deny that it's there. Because the Bible says it's there. And God, and also Romans 1, there in the New Testament indictment of all of this. 18 through 20. And he cites two things. One, the internal witness of God himself. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because that which is known about God, that which can be known about God, that which can be understood about God. See, men can understand certain things about God. Unbelievers out there, any idiot that's 5 years old or six and can think, can understand that there is a God. It doesn't take forever for this revelation to dawn on people. And this is why the age of accountability is so important. Because this woman, when she was advocating, oh, don't tell your children they have a sin nature, it'll bum them out. It's not consistent with Doc Spock and the feel-good way we're supposed to raise our kids. And you can't be their buddy and tell them they're sinful. Well, they are. People could understand certain things about God. And it doesn't take a lot of genius, and it doesn't really take a lot of time. But she said, you know, you just can't tell kids from their birth that they have a sin nature and they're under the wrath of God. You better tell them that. Because at some point they better believe. So that which can be understood about God is evident within them. There's an internal witness among them, inside them, that they know there is a God. For God has made it evident to them. For because of the creation of the world. The cause here is better. It's explanatory here. For because of the creation of the world. This explains why we know this witness is here. Because of the creation of the world, his invisible attributes. It's not temporal, I don't think, here. I think it's a causal deal. How do we know about God's eternal power and divine divinity? Because we can look at the world and see that this place, well, it's big. It's very big. I mean, most of us, as we get older, you know what happens. You know, of course, your world shrinks. You know, I don't probably go... Well, we went a couple of years ago to ordain Greg up there. But other than that, my world really probably doesn't go much between University Parkway and Clark Road. And I never get west of 41 to speak of, unless there's somebody here visiting or something and I have to go see, you know, if they're out there on the key, I'll go visit them. Because, you know, I'm in high demand, and so, kidding. But I don't get much east of 75. So you can mark off my world in that square. No, it's not really a square, I don't suppose. But within that rectangle. That my world's not much bigger than that any longer. I got outside of my comfort zone and went to Rich's last night. But that's as far as I've gone in a long time. So the world gets smaller. But the fact is, this idea of God's power and his divinity, you look at this world and it is a big place and it is complex and it works. That's the bigger deal to me. It all works. I mean, even if you believed in upward evolution, which is a doctrine of demonic darkness, that's all it is. There's a book called The Long War Against God, and this guy suggests that Satan was the original atheist. He's the one that has espoused this business of no God. Well, of course, that would make sense at some level. Even though he knows God exists, he probably really doesn't want to believe it. And this is one of the things. You look at Satan, and he's delusional. He espouses these principles that he knows are wrong. And he can't defend them. Not morally, obviously. But he's delusional. Well, and so are people. Because they look at this world, and they see the complexity of it, the complexity of the body. But if you believed in upward evolution, wouldn't you expect some problems every now and again? Things not to work? That things would be bad? I love it when they send out an upgrade to something and then your computer quits working because of the upgrade. I notice that right away when that happens. And yet, those glitches happen all the time in this imperfect world in which we live. Oh, we updated our program. Oh, now it doesn't work. Oh, good. That was a good upgrade. No, it wasn't. And we see this all the time in the technological world. Things go wrong. But upward evolution, they act like this has just gone smoothly forever. That there's never an inherent problem with anything. But you wouldn't expect that in upward evolution. Well, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen. Being understood through what has been made. So that, result here, they are without excuse. There isn't an unbeliever out there who doesn't know that God exists. Now, he may lie about it. He may try to claim he's agnostic. He may say, I don't know. He's lying. He knows God exists. That's what scared the daylights out of me when I was 5 or 6, realized, oh, there's probably a God. Well, I wonder what he wants. Well, if I didn't worry about it much for the next 15 years or so. But I eventually began to worry about it. And particularly, again, knowing, even as an unbeliever, I had this sense that something's really wrong in this world. This world's headed to a bad end. And I did know enough about the Bible. I've been exposed enough to say, okay, if this is all true, then Jesus is going to return shortly. The event that closes the church age, the rapture. And of course, I didn't know the difference between rapture and second advent then. I was an unbeliever. But I just, you know, you'd hear people talking about it all. I'd hear Christians talking about it. The Lord's coming soon, it's close. And I had some sense that, yeah, it probably was. And now how much closer is it now? That was back in 76. I thought it was close. Now we've only gone another 44 years since then. See, we all planned on being raptured when I got saved. I mean, they were setting dates back then. It's just that none of the dates have worked out. First one we thought, oh man, 40 years. Oh, we got it all figured out. 88. Israel's fig tree because Hal Lindsey says it was. It must be right. No, Hal Lindsey's wrong. Israel's not the fig tree. But the fact is, you start dating all that. Well, that's why this date setting thing doesn't work. Number one, they're working from the wrong dates to start with. And number two, they got the wrong idea that somehow this was designed for us to date the rapture. When he talks about his coming and he said, nobody knows. No, angels don't know. The Son didn't know. But God's revealed it to some charismatic fruitcake. I don't think so. I'll pass on that one. So they are without excuse. They know. And this is sad. This is where you have to have the iron in the soul. They know what they're doing. They know they're rebelling against God. And age of accountability, then from that point on, they're going to answer for it at some point. Well, see, while some fools deny God's existence, some fools recognize his existence. However, both groups reject his grace and treat him with disdain. Just knowing that God exists doesn't solve the problem. Psalm 74. I mean, knowing God exists gives you some advantage in that at least you can think, well, what does he want? Does he want anything? All that. Well, but if you don't know he exists, well, then you're really in the dark. Remember this, O Lord, that the enemy has reviled and a foolish people has spurned your name. This is one of the problems with the fool. Also, same chapter, verse 22. Didn't go. Arise, O God, and plead your own cause. This is the bottom line sometimes, too, in some of these imprecatory prayers. That it isn't so much that the psalmist is just praying, oh God, please come and massacre the enemies. I mean, there's some of that in there. But more is, God, vindicate your name. Vindicate your plan. Vindicate your righteousness. And to do that, you need to deal with these people. You need to deal with these evil people. And God knows all this. But he wants his people to be perceptive. Arise, O God, and plead your own cause. Remember how the foolish man reproaches you all day long. And so pretend you're God for a moment. And people are bad-mouthing you and maligning you and slandering you all the time. Is it any wonder you have indignation every day? No, it's not. And of course, all of this stuff they're doing is just hostile, negative, stupid, anti-truth. It's based on lies and all other things. Well, D, although God has made every provision for the human race to understand and enjoy his plan, fools reject the divine revelation and opt for their own self-chosen course in life. Proverbs chapter 1. And my contention is, at some point, if you're positive and you make these stupid choices and decisions, you reject the truth when you hear it, you rationalize disobedience. That at some point, if you're positive, God's going to lower the boom on you. If they're not positive, my experience at any rate tells me God may not do anything to them. God may just let them run their race. Let them do their deal. And which of course confirms them even more in their own stupidity, because then they think, I've spurned God and I'm getting away with it. Well, that's a safe way to approach life. I'm spurned God and I've gotten away with it. And I would add two words to that. So far. So far you've gotten away with it. When God really drops the hammer, what's going to happen then? And again, most people are not prepared for this. And I don't, hopefully all of us here, nobody wants to be on the end of that one. The wrong end of this thing. Misusing God, abusing him, failing to listen. And then we find out, oops, too late. Verse 7, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. However, fools despise wisdom and instruction. That's the problem. They don't like being told they're wrong. They don't like things that don't agree with them. And all of us kind of have that as part of our default mechanism, I think. We're prone to not like things that we disagree with. But we, as intellectually honest people, we have to get past all that. Okay, I may not agree with this, but am I right, or is this thing right? And I have to kind of figure that out and get past my own stupidity. That's another thing I pray for all the time. God, protect me from my own stupidity. And since I know you're stupid too, I pray the same thing for you. God, protect them from their stupidity. Because we all have the possibility of doing really stupid things that could really affect our life. Some decisions, as we all know, have greater consequences than other decisions do. Some decisions, what color socks I wore this morning, not a big deal. I generally try to find a pair that somewhat matches my slacks. You know, nobody likes seeing a guy wearing white athletic socks with in dress slacks. Dress slacks, sandals, and white socks. That's a look for you right there. That's the grandpa look. The retired Florida grandpa look specifically. So, verse 22 also, and I think we had seen that, yes, how long, O naive ones, will you love me? See, this is the problem. People are attached to their own stupidity, too. They don't hate it. I see myself, and I do stupid things. I hate it. I wish I could not do it. I'd like to get rid of it. But they love it. They embrace their stupidity, which is sad. And scoffers take delight in their scoffing. How long will you fools hate knowledge? See, they're not. See, the person that's a fool isn't benign in this. That's one of the whole points of all of this with the vocabulary and everything, is to see that the fool's not just out here sort of on an even keel and he takes all things and thinks through them and all this. No, no, no. This fool has a mindset that he's already against certain things like wisdom. He doesn't want to hear it. Why? Because wisdom points out that he's a fool. And then you either have to deal with the fact that, oh my God, I'm a fool, I'm delusional, or you don't, and most people won't. That's the sad thing. Also, verse 29, verse 27 begins all this, or 25 even. You neglected all my advice. You didn't want to be told you were wrong. That's what reproof is, just telling you you're wrong. When your dread comes like a storm. People think they know what fear is. Oh, wait till God uncorks a little bit more on this planet. They're going to find out what fear is. And your calamity comes like a whirlwind, a tornado or a hurricane, when distress and anguish come on you. Then they will call on me, but I will not answer. They will seek me diligently, but they will not find me. Because they hated knowledge. And they did not choose the fear of the Lord. They have a choice here. See, that's a choice. That's another whole thing that comes out of this. It's a choice they're making. And they're going to call. They're going to cry out. But it won't matter at that point. And after a point for the adjusted believer, while we offer grace and, okay, get your act together. Now's the time to act. There comes a point where if you just perceive and proceed and just keep engaging in stupidity and rationalization and rejection of the truth, and then things go bad, you may give me a call, but I may not answer. And I've heard people even say stuff like this to me. Well, I'm going to leave Bible class for now, but if God jams it or it doesn't work out, I'll be back. Will you? Will you really first? And secondly, the arrogance. What makes you think we're going to be here? If enough people leave, there won't be any Bible class. And the reality is people think things are going to go on forever and that this is going to be always available in the format that it's available today. It may not be. What happens? What happens if I die? You're going to have to get another pastor. And that's not going to be easy. You know, that'll be a challenge in and of itself. But the fact is, people act like, oh, well, this will always be there. Well, what makes you think so? Do you think God has never pulled a lampstand in his life? He warns those churches, I will come and remove your lampstand from its place. You will cease to be a vehicle of light for my plan. And of course, I don't want God to do any of that. I prefer to stay here and teach right up to the very end and be doing it right. Be one of those that he talks about we saw in that parable not too long back. Who is the faithful and sensible steward who gives his servants their rations at the proper time and is there to feed them and to encourage them, to challenge them? And my job isn't just to feed you. It's to reprove, rebuke, exhort. It's to point out you're wrong. And all of us have to grow up. We're all growing. As far as I can tell, I don't look at anybody and say, oh, well, that person isn't growing at all. I mean, there are people I do know like that, but not here today. And so generally speaking, I've gotten what I prayed for, a group of people that's serious about the truth, which is, that was what I wanted in the first place. And that's what's important. Also, chapter 12, verse 15. Well, we can just also start with verse 1. Whoever loves discipline loves knowledge. What? That doesn't sound right. But he who hates being told he's wrong is stupid. That's the reproof aspect of it. But the verse we're looking at here, or have on here, is 15. The way of a fool is right in his own eyes. And I guarantee you, there are believers right now that are completely maladjusted to God and his plan, and they will tell you they're positive and they're hitting on all cylinders. That's how delusional some people are. But a wise man is he who listens to advice. A fool's anger is known at once. But a prudent man conceals dishonor to recognize that anger does not bring honor to us. The anger of Ron does not achieve the righteousness of God. I say that to myself more frequently than you might imagine. You say, well, you're tipping your hand here. You got a problem with anger, don't you? Yeah, very astute to figure that out. And, of course, some of you have known me, so you know. Anyway, but I work on that. I don't just say, oh, well, I've got an anger grid, so be it. Just give in to it. Run with it. No. I haven't found that to be satisfying. And how do you feel when you're angry? Is it a fun feeling? Is it a fun experience to be out of fellowship and just, I want to kill God? No. It's not fun. I don't like it at all. Well, Jesus indicated that rejecting the gospel was as foolish as building a house on a foundation that would not support it permanently. That's our two builders. But intriguingly enough, in the sort of, we might call it parabolic teaching here, it's not really a parable, it's more of a simile, it's a comparison here. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them. It's not enough just to hear. You have to act on them. They may be compared to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell and the floods came and the winds blew and slammed against that house. Yet it did not fall, for it had been founded on the rock. The idea is bedrock. You build on a solid foundation that won't move. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rain fell and the floods came and the winds blew and slammed against that house. And it fell. And if you'll note in verse 25 and 27, both houses are subjected to the exact same test. One falls, one stands. And in many cases, people are subjected to these same tests in life. And for one person, it cracks them. And for the other person, they withstand it. They grow through it. They get stronger. For other people, they just quit. Just take the easy way out. That's another whole thing in all of this. The fool is going to be prone to do that, to try to take the easy way out, or what he perceives to be the easy way out. So both houses are subjected to the same test. It's just that one of them survives and one doesn't. And we'll see. Again, the Bema seat's going to be a real eye-opener for a lot of people. Probably for all of us. We're all going to have areas where we failed and fell short. But hopefully we'll be among those with maximum rewards, jumping up and down rather than slinking away in shame. Because again, it's very difficult to consider what it's going to be like when you have to stand there and look Jesus Christ in the eye. And we'll have the truth then to know, oops. Okay. That's good. That, I don't think people think about that enough. What it's actually going to be. One-on-one with Jesus. Uh-oh. I think about it, scares the daylights out of me. As it should, I think. We recognize the standards are high. Well, they're perfection. We're never going to reach that in this life. But we still have everything we need to succeed. That's the bigger element. That we can succeed at the Bema Seat. Well, once a person has rejected God's wisdom, he may well manifest it by rejecting the advice that those that represent God and his wisdom. As you might imagine, the communicator often takes the brunt of people's negative volition. Their refusal to deal with God also flows over into their refusal to deal with God's appointed representatives. And Jesus says, he draws this out very clearly, that there's a chain of command that works forward and backwards. The Father sent me, even so I send you, and then you go out and you take the message. And then he says, those who don't listen to you, don't listen to me. And those who don't listen to me, don't listen to the one who sent me. And so if the communicator's doing his job rightly, properly, and all that, he's speaking for the Lord whether people like it or not. But this is all done, again, through very imperfect human vehicles, weak vessels, as we say. Well, because I called and you refused, I stretched out my hand and no one paid attention. You neglected all my advice and didn't want my reproof. I will mock at you when your calamity comes. Also, verse 30, they would not accept my advice. They spurned. They rejected all my reproof. So they will eat the fruit of their own way. And they will be satiated with their own devices. When I look at people who are failing their mandates as soldiers in this warfare in which we find ourselves. We saw that deal in 2 Thessalonians 3 there. The unruly soldier. The disobedient soldier. and all of that. When people fail in all of this, you watch the mistakes they make and they tend to compound them and it tends to get worse and worse and worse. They won't apply certain doctrines. And one of the doctrines we're going to have again, it's going to come up here big time, is the doctrines in the household. If we can't apply in the household, what chance do we really have? Because that's the building block of, number one, society, of course. But even more importantly, the Christian household is the foundation of the church. It's the building block of the church. And so, if we fail in that regard, and I watch people and as they blow off their mandates and they don't do them, they don't get better, they get worse. And then they start blowing off other mandates. And then pretty soon they're not applying at all. You never see them in Bible class. They don't give. They don't apply towards other believers. They never encourage anybody. But will they deal with it? No, they'll sit there and think that they're okay because they're delusional. And that is not good. Also, Luke 10:16. So this is one of the things that goes with the territory. Every communicator better know this. That there are people who are going to say they're oriented to God, but they can't stand you. Oh, okay. I'm totally oriented to God's plan, but nope, you're not. Well, number one, you must be a pretty shrewd judge and all that. So the one, and this is the reverse part I was telling you about, the one who listens to you listens to me. So at a certain level, if I'm in fellowship teaching the truth and you reject it and blow it off and think you know better, you're not listening to Jesus. Not that I'm Jesus, I'm not. But he's saying there's a chain of command that runs both directions. And you're either oriented to it or you're not. And this is the challenge of being a pastor, because you know you're an imperfect person. You know you fail. You know you fall short. You know that there's no way you're perfect at all of this. And yet you have to get up there. I have to get up here day after day, week after week, month after month, and tell you how to live your Christian life and instruct you in all that in regard. Knowing that I'm not perfect. And that's one of the reasons sometimes I don't want to teach. I mean, sometimes I don't want to teach because I'm tired and I just don't feel good. Well, you probably have the same thing. You don't want to come to class. I'm tired and I don't feel good. And I don't mean you're sick, but, you know, you have a hangnail or something. And, you know. So, no, we fight through that, okay, and we move on. We don't feel good. But another thing that you may or may not have to deal with, I don't know, maybe you do, is that I don't like getting up here teaching, knowing I'm teaching something that I'm not proficient in all the time. And I even had one pastor tell me I won't teach certain passages because I don't apply them. That seems wrong to me. Maybe teaching them would up the bar here, and maybe it would help you too. Because sometimes we just have to take our lumps. I mean, at times I feel like I'm in the ring with Mike Tyson, and he's working me over. And you say, well, Mike Tyson, he's old, he's retired. Get in the ring with him. See? But the doctrine pummels me sometimes. And I have to sit there, right, knowing I'm guilty. Okay, here's what you should do. Well, you don't do it. Well, I'm working on it though. But I'm aware of these things. I'm not oblivious to them. You think, well, you seem oblivious. I'm not. I might seem oblivious, but I'm not. So the one who listens to you listens to me. Safely, I can say if I'm doing my job right and you're at odds with me, you're at odds with Jesus. There's just no problem. I mean, this is what the text is teaching. And the one who rejects you rejects me. And he who rejects me rejects the one who sent me. And so it goes back to God the Father. If you're maladjusted to the communicator. Now this is presuming he's doing his job right. He's intellectually honest. Wants to fulfill his niche. I don't want to be the one of those slaves where, you know, cut in pieces and assigned his place with unbelievers. Don't want to be that. Whatever all that means, don't want it. So, but there are people who are sitting out there listening online, rejecting God because they reject what I've told them. Because they know better. They're smarter than all the rest of us. And that just, at one level it galls me, but another level it goes with the territory, if you know what I mean. That this is just part of what you signed up for in teaching. So once a person has rejected God's wisdom, he may well manifest it, and probably will. I say may well, but he probably will manifest it. When three or four or five positive believers around you are telling you the same thing, That's the voice of God for you, unless you're not paying attention. If they're all on the same wavelength, they're probably being led by the Spirit, for one thing. And you're the one that's out of step. Well, we all get there. But the question is, what do you do about it? So I can even broaden this to the one who listens to me. Okay, well, what about positive believers that have the doctrine here, and they tell people the very same things that I'm telling them? Why? Because, oh, well, you're Ron's robot. You can't think for yourself. That's why. No, because you know it to be true. You're led by the Spirit. You understand the doctrine. And this is why we have obligations to one another. As we saw, there's proper functioning of every part. That every part, every person has something in here. From the youngest ones of them, the kids that we got, Ryan and Adam, any of the other kids that might attend, to the oldest one of us. Everybody's got something to contribute. And in fact, when Paul writes, we're going to see this coming up in chapter 6, he addresses the children just like they're functional members of the church. Well, they are. And they have the opportunity to apply in their niche and should seek out, as we all should, pursue the opportunities while we got them. Make hay while the sun shines. I just saw that on TV the other day, because that was the problem with hay. You can't make it in the dark. And really, you can't make it if it rains on it. It can really wreck it. Well, gee, God has provided spiritual leaders in his plan for the express purpose of instructing those that desire to acclimate to him. However, those that reject that provision will often suffer for their folly. Hebrews chapter 13. Hebrews 13, 17. Here, obey your leaders. Actually, it's literally be persuaded by your leaders. Listen to them and let their reasoning, their doctrinal sense, persuade you to the right viewpoint. Obey is sort of a secondary nuance of the word. The word really has to do with convincing people, being convinced of something is true. So be convinced by your leaders. Why did God put them there? Well, first, he's got a purpose in all this. As Paul said, no matter how bad we are, because he pointed out, I was a horrible sinner and all of this stuff, and yet God put me in the ministry. So then we have to act like, okay, well, why is this person in the ministry? Did they do it right? First thing you could do is evaluate any minister. Number one, are they trained? That's the first place you could start. Have they got the academic skills and qualifications necessary to teach? That means they have to know Greek, Hebrew, have to be fluent and understand hermeneutics, things like textual criticism and other things. You may not be 100% proficient in all these disciplines, but you don't have to be. And we have, well, there's textual commentaries on the Greek New Testament. In many cases, some of this donkey work has been done. I don't have to go back and reinvent the wheel all the time, thank God. But then he's got to have his systematic theology straight, and most people don't have that straight. So first you ask yourself, is he even qualified to be in the pulpit? Can he teach? He's got to be able to teach. That's the one thing there in the pastoral qualifications in 1 Timothy 3 that's not repeated to the deacons. Most of the rest of it is. But the deacons don't have to be able to teach. They don't have to do that. So obey your leaders. And the word leader is hegeomai. It actually is one, the hegemon is the governor. It's the word that was used of Pilate. He had supreme authority in that area, in that realm, where he ruled for Rome. And at some level, of course, the pastor has authority within his canon, but we don't have supreme authority. I mean, Pilate could kill people. I can't kill him. I'm not supposed to anyway. I don't want to. But obey your leaders and submit to them, for they keep watch over your souls. Sadly, some believers are not smart enough to watch over their own souls, so I do it. But if they won't listen, what good does it do? If they think they know everything, and I deal with people like that, or people that just flat out don't care, that's another kind of quality that you have to deal with. Well, they keep watch over your souls as those who will give an account. I'll have to answer for all of this. But if you blow me off and don't listen to me, that's going to be on you. I know I won't have to answer for that as long as I'm doing the job. And that's why Paul talks there in 1 Corinthians, chapter 3, about the be careful with what you build with. There are two kinds of building materials. Sound doctrine, gold, silver, precious stones, a human viewpoint, traditions of men, wood, hay, straw. Your own personal opinions, your own private hobby horses. Try to avoid those from the pulpit, of course. So they give an account. Let them do this with joy and not with grief. Why? Because it's not profitable for you. Aren't you in this to profit? But if you're not listening to your leaders, you're not going to profit. I don't care how smart you think you are. And all of us are tested with this. I had to sit there under a pastor and listen to the same things you're listening to now. And orient to it and submit to it. And at the time, you know, when you first start, you think, oh, this guy's great. He's perfect. Well, he's not. No, none of us are. And I always, my deal that I worry about when people come at me telling me, how, oh, you're great, this is great, it's wonderful. I'm thinking, okay, what am I going to do that's going to tick you off? Because then I know I'm going to get that. So I try to take it all with a grain of salt, but I want to do my job right. I want to teach at the highest level possible. And so I've always, for the most part, not always, but not too long into this, I've argued for peer review and for looking over things and for reviewing stuff and not just, oh, I said it and it's the law. That's pretty arbitrary to me, and I don't care for that approach. So their job, obey your leaders. There's a sense in which I'm the governor in that sense. And that has a lot of applications. Well, one, parental authority is the primary authority established for teaching children Bible doctrine. Proverbs 4, 1 through 5. But again, if you're maladjusted to these things that God has put in life to help people to not be fools, then you're going to continue to be a fool. Proverbs 4, 1 through 5. Hear, O sons, the instruction of a father, and give attention that you may gain understanding, for I give you sound teaching. Do not abandon my instruction. When I was a son to my father, tender and the only son in the sight of my mother, then he taught me and he said to me, let your heart hold fast my words, keep my commandments and live. And this all starts, acquire wisdom, as he says, acquire understanding. Do not forget nor turn away from the words of my mouth. And so as when you're raising your children, that's all you can do. And then at a certain point, then once they become of age, 18 legally in America, then they're free to go do what they choose to do. And if they're negative, they're going to reject the truth and walk away from it. And that's all you can do. You've done your part. It's painful. I will tell you, it's emotionally devastating, but what can you do? You just have to deal with it and suck it up, buttercup. Because it's not all fun and games. And we've all lost relationships because of doctrine. And that's just the way it is. But we've gotten better relationships. Again, as I've said, I would rather be with you people. But God's provided something better. And fortunately, some of us have a kid that's positive and actually does the stuff and is growing. That's just wonderful. That's just marvelous. And we would like that for all of our kids, no doubt. And grandkids and all of that. Now we're getting to the point where grandkids, pretty soon it's going to be great grandkids. Well, the good thing is if they're not interested in the truth, you won't have to deal with them much, sadly. But that's just a part of the sacrifice that has to be made. So you, the father here is responsible to teach. He knows this. And he exhorts his son, pay attention. And this implies to me, without coming out and directly stating it, that the father himself is spiritually successful. He's not doing this to no end. He's not doing it because he's a failure or he doesn't grasp all this. He knows this stuff. He wants his son to know this stuff. He wants his son to be blessed by God, as normal parents do. This is what we want for our kids. But are they going to come under God's blessing? Well, unfortunately, that boils down more to their volition than what we can do. We can do the right things. We can give them the right input. But they have to decide, ultimately. Also, chapter 6, verse 20. And Solomon knew this, and he taught his kids. David knew it and taught Solomon. How do you think Solomon got to be the wisest guy in the world? He had a pretty darn good foundation doctrinally from David. My son, observe the commandment of your father and do not forsake the teaching of your mother. In a normal Christian home, there should be there's some parallels going on between the wife and the husband. Both have responsibilities for the children. In fact, when he talks that about children, he'll say, children, obey your parents. Plural. You have a mother and a father. And I know how boys are by the time they get to be about, I don't know, 12, 13, 14. First, they've gotten smarter than everybody. And they've just been blessed with massive amounts of wisdom at that age. And they're ready to blow off the authority, you know. My mom would tell me to do something. I don't have to do that. Well, wait till your dad gets home. We'll see. Well, that was all the threat it took. Because I knew, I don't want to mess with dad. And the male is typically, the parent, the man, the husband, is typically the greater disciplinarian within the household. I understand that. Because of the women's weaker nature and all of that. And some of that, it's emotional. I get that too. Women are more emotional about this than men sometimes. But it doesn't mean we don't have emotions, ladies, just because we can deal with stuff. We have them. It hurts. We don't like our kids abandoning the truth and forsaking the teaching, but it happens. And so in terms of discipline, you have to have some iron in your soul when you're raising kids, and you got to grab that belt and just bust them a good one. But God's made a place to spank them. And it's a safe place to spank them. It's very fatty. And, as long as you're not abusing your child, you just want to make it hurt, because that's what God wants. God wants to make it hurt when we fail. Or why would we ever change anything? If our failures didn't bring some repercussions, some discipline, some problems, we'd never change anything. Some people don't change it even when they are getting disciplined. That's really dumb. Proverbs also 15:20. A wise son makes his father glad. Yes, that's true. I can testify to that. But a foolish man despises his mother. And the way they live their life as a fool, it's essentially saying that your parental teaching was of no value and all that. Also, Ephesians 6:4, that's the one we've got. We're going to be coming up on here shortly. And it is intriguing, and I haven't gotten to this verse yet. I just finished up chapter 5, and I'm just kind of looking into chapter 6 here. But it is intriguing that when the children are commanded in verse 1, children, obey your parents, plural, in the Lord. For this is right. Now, and the word in the Lord there does not modify parents. It's not saying, if your parents are Christians, you have to obey them. But if they're not, you don't have to. In the Lord modifies obey. The fact that children are appealed to under this deal of positional truth, we're all in the Lord. We're all a part of His body. Indicates that, number one, He takes them as normal functioning members. And there's no doubt, I think, and a number of commentators have pointed this out, but it was something it wasn't as though it was lost on me. And that is, you got to imagine, when Paul sends this letter and they get it at Ephesus, when are they going to read it? Probably at a church service. And this also indicates that children were a part of the church services, a part of the worship services. They have their things to contribute. Maybe not as much as adults do, but they still are viewed as functional and active members of this organization called the church. But then when it gets into discipline and all that, the fathers are only addressed, because they tend to be, again, the more strict and stern disciplinarians. And this is a compliment to the wives. See, many wives rebel against this. They say, I don't want my children disciplined. I'm not going to discipline them. I'm not going to let anybody else discipline them. And guess what? That's just maladjusted to the maximum. And that will condemn the kids right there, that attitude. That'll condemn them to the stupidity of the mother. And this is why God established the world the way He did. It's a patriarchy. It's always been a patriarchy. If you're oriented to all this, it doesn't matter. But it's not as though, even though it's a patriarchy, the women don't have the same abilities and the ability to contribute and apply in the local church and do all that stuff. They do. But here the fathers are addressed because they do tend to be sometimes too demanding. We've done that. I've done it. I've been too demanding. You might find that hard to believe, but I have. Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger. Don't burden them down with unnecessary, unrealistic things that they can't do. But things that they can do, you can expect out of them and should expect out of them. But bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. All right, well, our time is gone. We're going to have to stop there today. We will go ahead and pick up here Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in these things. We thank you for the positive volition that you have established here, and pray as we grow into a habitation for you that we do so in a way that is pleasing in your sight, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.